We're supposed to have a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. The Maharal actually has this out of order. He has this later on. So the first one we did from the mute one was mute Skola. If you take a look at the bottom of the first page I photocopied, and the first bottom first column, you see that? A chop palace. So yes, we said mute Skola could either mean one's supposed to diminish the amount of commerce one is engaged in, or one is supposed to do a little bit of commerce. So the Maharal says, takes the first approach. Chopalos mute Skola klomar means shaloye about maso maso. It should be a person who has a lot of negotiations or a lot of commercial activities. Holech b'skola, that he goes out on to a lot of business trips. A person who goes on business trips obviously is traveling, so that in and of itself is distracting. Like they said, k'moshe amru k'shkamu per ketat ma'avin. This is the Gemara says in Masechta Eruvin. Lo ve'eber layami. The Torah is not over the sea. That's a quote from a pasuk. The verse says the Torah is not over the sea. Amar Rava. Rava said, Lo timotzei hatorah. Torah will not be found. B'sachronin, to people who do or are merchants with tazarin, and people who are peddlers. So merchants and peddlers, they travel around a lot. They travel around a lot. They certainly don't have the attributes which we spoke about before of Yishuv, of being calm and tranquil. They don't have that capacity because they're going always from place to place. This is a new place. Parvianu Zegam came from the Sivas Olam. We explained this also, says Maral, another sefer is called the Sivas Olam. The Gam Lamala Biyanu Zegam, we already explained it elsewhere, he says, in this book, above, Baorech at length, Eitzav Aloka Amara Viskora Machkin. Not everybody who is involved in a lot of merchant activity is he can become smart. Then Kamakam Harak says this is not the place to go into it. Again, we said yesterday that it could be taken the other way as well, but the bottom line is he's saying that a person who's concerned with commercial activity very often, because he has to travel a lot and because he's very much engaged in trying to make a significant amount of money, so that distracts him from his capacity to acquire wisdom. Okay, Hakon Beis, the 22nd, again, he has a different order than we do. Mute Ticha, diminishing one's conversation. By his bias, Zelamal, he says, this we already explained above, Kimar B'dvarim, Mar B'shtus. A person who speaks a lot becomes very stupid. And I explained this at greater length. Eitel, by another Mishnah in Avos, it says, V'loma tzlasi laguf tov elashtika. I didn't find anything which is better for the body than silence. Ki ashustika, because silence, is siman chokma, is a sign of wisdom. V'amar betzicha, somebody who engages in a lot of chatter, ain bo siman chokma. He doesn't have a sign of wisdom. And, you know, it was in and of itself, it sounds like it's not quite a problem. Okay, so you don't have a sign of wisdom. So, but maybe you're wise, even though you're not displaying signs of wisdom. Maybe inside you are a wise and sagacious person, even though you chatter and talk all the time. So says Maral, He says, Shasicha mivatelas pu'ulas hasecho. When one chatters, then one is canceling, or one is negating the activity of one's intellect, meaning that when one is involved in chatter, which does not require any type of intellectual involvement because it's just idle and frivolous, so then your mind is not involved and it is atrophying. Yes.
I would benefit from some clarification or some texture around idle chatter. We were even talking about it earlier today with Rabbi Reich's share about discouraging idle chatter even within the context of a marriage or a conjugal relationship. So if you can just elaborate, shed some light on that. In other words, sometimes in human relations, you know, it's nice to have a little, relationship building.
Well, we did speak about that. We said that that's the other alternative. That's what the Vilna Gaon says, that you're supposed to have a little bit of sikha, that's a little bit of chatter, not so much, right? The two ways of looking at it. One is looking at that the mission is telling you to diminish your amount of chatter, and the other is to say that you should be involved in a little bit of chatter, which are not going to contradict each other. But, you know, the type of conversation which I imagine falls into chatter, besides, you know, all the negative stuff, like Lashon Hara, you know, and stuff like that, it probably stuff which has to do with, say, sports, following, you know, with, I think there are people who, in New York, yeah, I didn't see this as much, but in Chicago, sports was, it's like, you know, like a pagan religion. So, you know, that's kind of, kind of like, there's no intellectual involvement in that. That would be a good example. Perhaps certain types of political discussions would be a similar idea. And also, anything which really doesn't engage the mind is really what he's saying here. If there's something which has engaged the mind in an intellectual pursuit in some way, shape, or form, in other words, if you're discussing something which requires more profound understanding, so then, and even say you were discussing sports, but you're discussing all sorts of theories of how one plays baseball better. So then that would be something that has some intellectual component of it. But otherwise, it's just idle chatter. That's the idea. And a person is supposed to avoid it because, says the Maharal, if you're not using your brain, then your brain tends to shrivel and die.
Are they talking about idle chatter that has nothing to do with Torah?
Yeah, absolutely. Right, nothing to do with Torah, yes. So it's interesting because the rabbis say, except the Sukkah says, that in terms of Torah, it says, Sichas Chulin shall, Afilu Sichas Chulin shall, Tamid HaChacham and Sichas Limud. Even the mundane talk of a Talmud Chacham, of a scholar, requires study. Meaning that you assume that a scholar, even when he talks about something mundane and plain, there is something more profound in it. Because a scholar doesn't say things which don't reflect in some way, shape, or form his scholarship. But that's specifically because of the person who's saying it, we assume that what he says has weight to it. The idea of miut sichos is, as you mentioned before, it's mentioned earlier in Pirkei Avos, it mentioned that ha'otav sicha im ha'isha. There it says one is not supposed to have lengthy discussions with a woman, right? So it would seem here that this is going beyond that, obviously, right? This is talking about, they're just sort of giving advice to the generic individual, right? Telling him, you know, even if you do chatter, even if you do involve yourself in mindless conversation, but at least don't do it with women, right? And here it's saying that if you want to be a sage, you want to be wise, so then you have to refrain from doing it on a much larger scale. Because you have to try and be reflective and try and contemplate things and only speak when your mind is engaged. I just saw this morning an article in the paper. I think it's obvious. It's only the article to tell you this, but the article said that older people are less likely to succumb to Alzheimer's and all those kinds of conditions if they remain creative into old age. In other words, the more the mind works, even though Alzheimer's seems to be a kind of disease, but nevertheless, the more the mind works, the more likely it is to thrive for a longer period of time. And in fact, you rarely find, at least as far as I know, you rarely find that great sages become, you know, senile in the same way that people who are of lesser wisdom become. And I guess that's what they studied and came to this conclusion. So they said it's not just obviously wisdom, but they said any type of creative activity helps. That's good, any type of creative activity. But we're specifically talking about acquiring wisdom. Yeah?
That's a good question. One is like taking, I don't know, we're not meant to take this like silence on its face value. Like if someone asks you a question, the sign of wisdom is someone has a moment of silence before they answer.
Right.
So to me it's kind of like that's what silence means rather than like someone asks you a question and they say silence.
No, I think mm-hmm. I think that those are true. When I understand the silence, it means that you don't seek out people to have conversations with. But you don't seek to be as social as you possibly can. That's what it would mean.
You can be a social butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a social butterfly. I'm a social butterfly. That's how I always started in college.
Okay, that's number one.
I'll actually throw out another question then, because then surely there's a balance of by seeking out social activity, it's mixed to smile, to have interaction with people, to listen to people, to make them feel better. So I imagine it's just a case of finding a balance between.
Yeah.
And secondly, like things
you know,
like...
I think all this only works if you have common sense. If you don't have common sense, this mission becomes very dangerous.
Yeah, it's
possible. Yeah. One of the ways in which the Orthodox Jews are known Orthodox Jews who are slightly psychotic, are known to terrorize their households is by citing the Gemara, maybe it's a Braisa somewhere, which says you're not allowed to speak at the time that you're eating. So therefore, some people actually enforce absolute silence at the time that they're eating a meal. So Judaism and psychology, so I do a few cases like that cited. And the thing is that it's a distortion, obviously, because what it means is that you shouldn't speak while you're eating because you might swallow something the wrong way. That means while you're actually chewing, you're not
supposed to speak.
Right, people take it the wrong way. So people who lack common sense, they can distort anything.
Or dominated by something else, some other trait. I mean,
right.
Judaism also lends itself to OC
disorders. Right, of course, of course.
There's another thing about, in a certain conversation, like if Warren wants to buy a new suit, and I know a really good place to buy a new suit, that's what I would chat with. It's just kind of like, hey, there's this great place. I know.
Well, big mitzvah to tell that, yeah. Of course. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the other chapter just comes down to things that are just, as you say, like sports.
Right. Really things which are meaningless. It happens to be that, you know, in to get us to speak about perhaps a little bit of a deeper level, is that of course conversation with another person is the glue of a relationship, right? You can't have relationships, generally speaking, with another person unless you communicate with them, right? Sometimes you can communicate in writing, sometimes you communicate by non-verbally, but generally speaking, the communication takes place verbally. And the depth of your communication with another person is directly related to the quality of your communication. Mm-hmm. So most people, when they have relationships with other people, so those relationships are relatively shallow because the conversation is relatively shallow and the concerns are relatively shallow. So therefore, it builds a more profound relationship with somebody else if the discussion takes place on a more substantial, a more intellectual level. The Rambam at the beginning of Avos, on the second Mishnah, he brings down Aristotle. He quotes Aristotle, and Aristotle said there are three levels of friendship. One level of friendship is that people just get together because they want to accomplish a common goal. Right? So it's convenient for them to be together. It's like a marriage of convenience, so to speak. And they each get pleasure from the fact that they're connected in some way, shape, or form. The next level, he said, is a level where people are comfortable with each other and sharing their innermost thoughts and concerns and all their issues which they have in their life. And the third level of friendship, he says, which is the highest level of friendship, is one in which two people are committed to help each other achieve some common and transcendent goal, something which is a purpose, very purposeful and very meaningful thing. So, of course, all human relationships fall into one of these categories. You have your acquaintances with which your relationship is one that's, very superficial. The people with whom you relate in this world will be at best acquaintances, right? You'll have a casual and superficial relationship with them. Then there are people with whom you have a more profound relationship. In other words, you feel that these are people in whom you can confide and with whom you can share your secrets and get good advice. That's the second level. There are very few friends of that sort. That's already not an acquaintance, that's a friend. And then you have somebody that's very rare, and perhaps there are one or two people you have in this world of this sort, who with whom you share a common goal, a common purpose, and you are attempting to strive towards that common purpose together with this person. That's interesting, to digress a little bit on this, is that the Rambam put a marriage into the first category, the lowest category. Because the Rambam at that time, it was not perceived that together with your wife, you're going to go and ascend towards lofty purpose and transcendent goals. That's something you did with your friends, your fellow philosophers, wherever they might be. The wife is kind of like a convenience to have, but it's not the same thing as a more profound philosophical and intellectual friend. So nowadays we would not say that. Nowadays we would say, I'm not sure if it's because or more romantic, or because women are brighter, or whatever the case may be. But nowadays, we would say that, ideally speaking, a marriage should take place at that third level, where two people are joined together with a common, meaningful purpose, which they're trying to achieve in life. So, again, sikha is the most superficial form of relationship. So therefore, to do that is not meaningful, nor is it going to advance anything positive in the world to any substantial extent. Because an acquaintance, our acquaintances are a dime a dozen. It's really, having acquaintances is not the same thing as having a true friend. I heard many years ago, this is when I was in Shalvim, right after high school, that the Mashgiach there used to tell boys who were getting married that they shouldn't spend more than 2 hours talking to their wives a day. Now, at first I thought this was actually terrible. You don't want to speak with your wife all the time. After I was married, I realized you never speak to your wife 2 hours a day. If you sleep with each other for 15 minutes, that's a lot of time, you know, depending on your schedules. So, in fact, 2 hours is an awful lot of time. And that's what his definition of al-tarvah sikhma isha was, to go beyond those 2 hours. But, again, once you're married for a while, it doesn't happen. You never get anywhere close to 2 hours. Okay, so that's the idea of mil sikha. Did I miss you? Do you want to say something? You want to say something
more? I have no idea.
What?
I don't think so.
No, you didn't want to say that? Okay.
I might have,
but I just okay, yeah, you lost it. That's good. Okay. So, what are our tactics?
He's practicing what you preach.
So he says, V'ticha sabra azeh shumil ticha, this thing which is to have less type of conversation, superficial conversation, where you so gadol al chokhma. It's a very fundamental aspect of acquiring wisdom. Ha'chav gimel, 23rd, the new timing to diminish the amount of pleasure which a person tries to accomplish in this world. Again, yesterday said to me, so you can interpret it to mean, well, you should have a little bit of pleasure, but here it's talking about to diminish pleasure. Dover said, this is kiarodik akara tanugi magufnim. This is because somebody who pursues physical pleasures, hareyu bal guf. He is, literally means the master of a body. But it means here, he's focused on his body. Uba'achomer, literally it means he's the master of his material self. But here it means he's focused on his material self. V'ein roi, he is not suitable, sheikna chokma, to acquire wisdom, shuhetech haguf, which is the antithesis of the body. Kamo shubiyano lamala itzokhaki dato shokera. Like we explained above, at the Mishnah we saw yesterday, where it says you should eat bread with salt and drink water and lie on the ground, and that's the way to accomplish Torah. So as we mentioned yesterday, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do it, but rather that you have to be prepared to do it. You should not be a slave to the accomplishment of physical pleasures, because that will lead you away from the ambition to become wise, right? A person can can pursue pleasures and remain an idiot at the same time. So therefore, this is in which you have to be avoided. The Rama says the Maharal, the Eishlach shows. One can ask the question, again going with his philosophy, the Mashma Dapka Mute Tainuk. It sounds that you're supposed to diminish pleasures. Avo Tainuk Ba'amo Mutter. But to have some pleasures, okay. Just not to have too much. But a little bit is okay. And yesterday we said, the way we explained yesterday, was where there is our constant pleasure is good. Such as on Shabbos, right? When there's mitzvah on the Shabbos. But my Rav is not going to go with that.
I have a question about pleasure.
Yes.
Is it the level of pleasure or the amount of time you're having the pleasure for?
That's a good question. I don't know. I can't. I would imagine that it has to do with the amount of time you spend either seeking or indulging, not the quality of the pleasure.
If you were very effective in getting very, very high, naturally.
Oh, you go back to the magic
very,
muscle?
No, yeah. Substances also like natural high.
Are you okay?
That'd be like a mitzvah to enjoy, not to enjoy as much as you can.
Well, it depends. Depends what we're talking about. Not everything a person enjoys is okay. But there's an interesting.
You enjoy dinner, and you
enjoy okay, no, that's fine. There's an interesting Yushalmi. Yushalmi says, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is down. It says that Asid Adam Lipein Din V'Cheshvan, the person is eventually going to have to give an accounting. Al Kol Mashrosa Ein Avul Achal Eitim, which is I beheld and he did not eat. Meaning that if you see a nice fruit, you see a nice vegetable, maybe even a nice steak, then Hashem says it's there for you to indulge. You're supposed to eat it and enjoy it and see what a great world I made. So therefore, if you don't eat it, so when you come up to heaven, God's going to say, what's the matter? You didn't like my mangoes? You know, it's not, example. But that's, you have to, so yes, there is this concept of doing it, but of course doing it L'shem Shamayim. In other words, the idea is being when one does, involves himself in pleasure, even heightened pleasures, one is supposed to think one of several possible thoughts, either that by enjoying this now I'm going to be able to serve God better later on, or this great pleasure which I have demonstrates what a wonderful world God made, and so on and so forth. One should try and have that, at least in the back of one's mind at the time. So the idea of pleasure is an interesting one, by the way. Pleasure is, of course, not happiness. Right? I want to make that clear. I think it's obvious, but just in case it's not. Well, a person who is enjoying pleasure might be a very miserable person. At this point, he's deriving pleasure from some physical activity, but this is a physical thing which is going on. But that doesn't have anything to do with his inner state. So at his core, he might remain a miserable person even though he's accomplishing much pleasure. Happiness usually doesn't have anything to do with having pleasure, but rather it's something to do with a more profound sense of accomplishment. The thing is, if a person can engage himself in pleasure enough times, so again, that can distract him from thinking whether he's happy or not. But if a person actually would stop focusing on pleasure and measure whether he was happy, happiness has nothing to do with the amount of pleasure that you enjoy. Okay, true happiness. So Vaneva, the moral question is, what's the measure here? In other words, before, in the previous that mission said you're supposed to eat bread and water, so it sounded like no pleasure. And here it says all you have to do is diminish the pleasure. How do you reconcile the two missions? So he says, "Vayza kakashia klal." This is not a question at all. Should far be honest, as already explained, "Tiena peyush should sorry klal knows natural." It's the interpretation of the previous mishnah. It's not that a person has to torture his himself. That's not required. Shelo amru shatera miskayim b'misha amemis atzmo ala zera. They didn't say that the Torah is. There is a quote from the rabbis which says that the Torah is only sustained in somebody who kills himself over the Torah. Kills himself over the Torah means that he's willing to go without sleep, without food, you know, all sorts of things which normally would be considered to be unhealthy. So my Rao is saying, wait a minute, it's about this principle. So he says, that which they said, that Mishim named himself Asma of the Torah is a good thing, somebody who kills himself over the Torah, Rapshu Oite Bishvi, Rapshu Oite, that's only when he does it specifically for learning. The hainu shim lo yuchal limot, meaning that if you will not be able to eat rakimot kapas ma'af, in other words, if it's a choice of having steak or eating bread, having steak and not learning, or eating bread and learning, so then you have to choose eating bread and learning. That's what it means to say. Somebody just says on top, means to sleep on the floor, to drink water, that you should do if the alternative is not to learn. But to torture oneself for nothing, for no reason, is not something which we advocate. Mara, of course, doesn't advocate it. There were people who did advocate it. Obviously, there were Kabbalists in the old days who used to afflict themselves for the purpose of afflicting themselves, meaning in order to atone for their sins and generate merit for the world, right? Because since they proposed their suffering...
Isn't there a sect?
A specific sect?
Yeah.
I don't think it was a specific sect. There were people. I don't think there were... I was thinking it was a type of capitalist.
Yeah.
And they used to do that in order for the... particularly in medieval times, in order, again, to generate merit for them, for the world, not for themselves, generate merit and in order to atone for sins. So don't believe in that anymore, the Maharal, or at least it doesn't work for us. In other words, when we suffer, we just get annoyed. We actually find it to be a lofty experience, but rather it's a nuisance. So therefore, we don't usually do this anymore. But there was theoretically a time when at least there were individuals who did it. But Maharal is saying that's not required. Now, the thing is, we have to mention that obviously... in modern Western society, nobody is going to suffice with bread and water. Even the most ardent Talmud Chacham will not suffice with bread and water. It just doesn't work that way. So the question is, what happened along the way? In other words, why now do bread and water not suffice? Everybody else, certainly here in Muncie, you know, most people have pretty nice houses. I think they're not luxurious, but you know, they have their houses. Nobody here is sleeping in a tent, as far as I know. Because they can't, because they want to learn Torah and They say, bought a house, they'd have to make money to meet the mortgage, and so on and so forth. So the question is, what exactly our heter, what permits us to go and seek a higher level of comfort than the bare minimum, which is equal, which would be optimal, perhaps, for learning Torah, not because you want to afflict yourself, rather because then you wouldn't have to worry about how to make money. You wouldn't have to worry about where you're going to get your mortgage payments, where you're going to get your food from, etc., etc. So the question, actually, it's not so simple to answer. Because certainly in American society, in American Jewish Orthodox society, just like all the rest of American society, there is almost no value placed on privation. There's almost no value placed on depriving oneself of anything. On the contrary, the American dream is to have more and more, right? I don't know about the other countries, but America is like that, and I imagine other countries like that as well. So the question is, and if you drive around Muncie enough, you'll see plenty of houses that indicate that many Orthodox Jews have bought into this concept. So the question is, how do we reconcile that with authentic Judaism? It's not so simple. Yeah?
My thought is, having been around a lot of different facets of the culture that does, quote-unquote, not put value on deprivation, whatever, it's not so much like that they, when they do have, it becomes this polar situation. They said, oh, if I enjoyed these things, if I didn't put value on this, then when I'm Labdula Baltuva in the sense of turning away from this, I turn away from those. It's a casting away of those things. Those things mean nothing to me. Throwing all your money away, pulling the St. Francis. Someone say St. Francis. This Francis, pulling a Franciscan trip, and it just, you know, just, oh, nothing, none of this means anything to me. And they do have that, a component of, because the asceticism is not a Jewish thing. But that is something that of the worldview is generated, that people do dispense with everything, and oh, I have nothing. That is a Goyish thing. I mean, it's most certainly
mostly Catholic.
Yeah, that's true, but you're addressing something other than I'm addressing. You're explaining why a person doesn't, in our modern age, should not seek deprivation. That's true. But the question is, what right do you have to go and seek a second car?
Okay, so that would be the other passage of the thing is, with Judaism, it doesn't even seem to be against that so much as it seems there are passages in dimensions of people's lives wherein there is a thing of, well, we don't feel we have a need versus a want here. We just feel we have a need here, and we don't need this second car. We may want one.
It's also a question of necessity.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is that
you live in a suburb, and you can't go any place unless you
have okay, a car. Okay, fine, so you need two cars, but there's one of them has to be electric. Okay,
because the other one's great.
What about a Lexus? Why is somebody getting a Lexus instead of a Toyota? Or for that matter, a Chevy?
Because you're a big trucker.
Okay.
Safer than a used car.
Whatever third and fourth and fifth cars you see in the driveway.
By the way, as I always tell people, I have no desire for any fancy car except the Rolls Royce.
What? You got
any
more tears?
Only one is enough. Yeah.
It's one of the problems I find with the limit of what we know. Because we're meant to treat everybody with kindness. But how are we treating everyone with kindness with actions that we don't even realize how it's affecting other people? So with all our gluttony and kind of with our such a level of greed that means like so many houses, there's so many television sets, there's so many cars, and the actual industry that's going into making these is causing environmental problems around the world, that's causing problems for human beings. So where's kind of like the level of, there's a whole load of stuff we don't even realize how it affects people in a bad way.
That's a good, interesting question. The problem with that issue is that Judaism has not had to face that as a society in about 2,500 years. So in other words, it's not about problems which are really problems of societies, not of individuals. In other words, if I refrain from buying a third television, I'm none, but let's say I have in my house six computers. So if I refrain from buying...
The rabbi might have been a former roommate of mine.
One, two... Three, four, five. Yes, that's good. So of course, if I refrain from buying an extra computer, so that would be kind of meaningless in the grand scheme of things. even though it does obviously create problems for the ecology, and especially when you throw out that old 486, which I'm going to do. So then actually you're going to, it's not environmentally friendly. But that thing which is society as a whole has to treat, and it's very hard for an individual to do something about it. So much so that I don't think an individual has the responsibility to actually ensure that that happens. You can, if he's somebody who can, let's say, organize lots of people to do it, then that's something else.
There's a big problem with that, Alex. I mean, if you look at the CFC emissions that were causing the ozone problem, before we knew about them, that was a very good argument to not even worry. Once we know about them, we actually know they're affecting, we did something about it, and now the ozone...
Yeah, but it's not we. In other words, the government of the world did something about it. It's not so much individuals do something about it.
Don't you think the individuals make up
no.
the...
No. The way
they don't accumulate to a whole system. People don't vote and it doesn't... People vote and it doesn't matter?
Let me explain to you what I mean.
I'm going to ask you another question that's related, but...
I didn't answer this one yet.
No, it's part of the same question. What about dress code?
Dress code?
Yeah, because some people are not supposed to be ostentatious when they dress. And others buy the best and the most expensive.
Yeah. Okay, well, so I'll come back to that.
That goes into part of the same question.
Okay. What somebody else had a question want to throw in here?
Mine's on a more practical level, and that is that, you know, for a person for whom it feels incumbent to be fruitful and multiply, then you've got the question of cost per child in K through 12, a college, a home that can house everybody, food on the table, and it's, I think, a challenge to reconcile that kind of lifestyle with spending all day in a yeshiva studying.
Okay, so fine. So we have a bunch of questions here. Okay. I'll try to go in order. In terms of the ecological issue, it's a very... I have to look at this on the societal level. What I mean by societal level is the way societies work is that, let's say there is a society of 1,000 people, and 900 of those people are followers. You know, they just go with the flow. And the 100 people, I'm being charitable now, 100 people are leaders. All 100 people don't get involved in the same leadership drive. In other words, one guy will get involved in environment, and the other guy will get involved in healthcare, and another person will get involved in women's rights, and so on and so forth. And then those people who are the activists drive, to a certain extent, the followers, and they drive also by having enough of their type of activists together with a whole bunch of the follower people getting together to actually go and affect government policy. But it doesn't work if one of the 900 followers, and that changes entire society, but if one of the 900 followers on their own just thought, you know what, I'm going to be frum in my own way, so to speak, and I'm going to make sure that I do things which are environmentally absolutely beyond doubt, that's a nice thing. But it's not going to change on a global level what a person and what has to be done in order to make a real difference. It doesn't make a significant dent. Let me finish. So now in this world, every person is created with a certain drive which drives that person. That's why some people are activists for one cause, and some people are activists for another cause, and so on and so forth. So therefore, and sometimes those causes, of course, the flip, like you have societies where people feel that abortions are great, and in the same societies, other people feel that abortions are terrible, and that's one of the major issues today in America. But what happens is that you are going to be an activist, hopefully, if you're a leader type, not one of the follower types, you're going to be an activist for things that you perceive as being close to your heart. And if you have the capacity to be an activist in that way, then that's what you should go ahead and do. And that would have, you will have a major impact on society. The problem is, I shouldn't say problem, the issue is we have to recognize that most people don't have that capacity. Most people don't think that way, most people don't think. So therefore, I'm not sure what you tell an individual. In other words, if you go to an individual and say, listen, Yanko, I want you to start doing X, Y, Z because it's better for the environment, right? That's not the way to go about it. Find an efficient way of going about it. So you have to go through the lobbying, through persuasion, and through the government. So although you're probably not going to be happy with this answer, but this is my actual belief, is that a person is not required as an individual, unless he can be an activist about this, to follow suit, to on his own adopt all sorts of stringencies with specific issues. It's only if only an activist approaches him, or he himself is an activist, that these things actually have significance. Does that make any sense to you? You all agree?
It does, and I can see where you're coming from. But what about the value of the way we affect everybody else's lives, and even the smallest of actions?
You're right. There is a factor that which you have in other people's lives, but with every small action. But there, at some level, there are certain actions which are so infinitesimally affecting others that we don't take them into account. For example, just a wild example, if somebody walks across, the high school students from Ramapo High School walk across our Samath lawn to get home, right? So it affects our Samath lawn, right? So it's devastating impact. No, it's not devastating impact. It has a little bit of an impact. So that level of impact, it wouldn't be even a mitzvah for the Ramapo High School students, were they to be keeping mitzvahs, to refrain from going through the grass. Because we have assumption that there's a level of such minimal impact on another individual that it's not something which you have to be concerned about. So the question is, here too, you're right, my one computer, if I throw it out the wrong way, it may well have a negative impact on the environment. It will, but the impact will be so negligible that I'm not sure that necessarily this is a significant thing. Is that what I'm trying to say?
I do, but I keep on coming back to this whole kind of thing of like the drip of water on the rock. Like if that person starts walking home across the grass and then he starts telling everybody and everyone starts coming along, mm-hmm. and then you've got the whole school realizing this is a shortcut and they're all walking across the grass.
Oh, because there's an activist there. There's the activist grass walker.
But even if you're intending to be an activist, just by your actions, mm-hmm. and like if you know what you're doing is right, then you do it. People are curious. If you're doing something different to other people, they're like, what are you doing? Okay, most of the problems are like, put it off, whatever. But there might be one kid who sees what you're doing, and you think, you know, I want to know more about that. They go to school, they study, and then they become the actors.
Mm-hmm.
So you've carried out the mitzvah, but that surely the greatest mitzvah, because you're not even doing it for any egotistical reason, you're just doing it because it's right. Because you believe it's right.
I'm not sure, I hear what you're saying. It makes sense. And I don't disagree. What I was trying to explain, and I think we're talking on different levels. What you're saying is that a person who has truly a spirit of volunteerism, and is really an altruistic person, will be concerned on every level of his existence that whatever he does is not harmful, but rather beneficial. Or at least not harmful, and preferably beneficial. Because that is the character, the trait of a person who is an altruistic person. But I don't disagree with you. I agree with you about that. What I'm trying to say is that, on the other hand, the person who is not of that type, in other words, the person who doesn't have that completely altruistic typology, and he doesn't have, you know, that complete control of every aspect of his life down to every detail, he's not a bad person if he doesn't go and do make sure to do everything in the most, whatever, environmentally friendly or impact-free way.
Another question to you, in secular world, in the course of law, ignorance is not necessarily a defense. Now, if it comes about that people are doing something, and then someone finds out that what they're doing is so bad, and then they change the law. Before the law was changed, what they were doing was bad, but they just didn't realize they were doing bad. So in Judaism, if you kind of like don't realize you're doing something bad, you
in a halakhic framework.
Yeah, and you still judge when you go into a long bar by...
No. No.
No, you're not judged.
No.
Only by what you knew was right or wrong.
Of course you're not. There's in Judaism, there's din, the strict level of law, and there's lifting the shuras of din, that which goes beyond the level of the law, right? So a person is judged, the judgment is, did you meet the level of the law? It's not that you go beyond the level of law. That is something which is a wonderful thing to do, right? And maybe you'll get tremendous reward in the world to come for it. You shouldn't do it for a reward in the world to come, because then it's not really beyond the letter of law. You're just greedy. But there is a level, of course, of functioning above the law. But if something is not forbidden by the law, strictly speaking, we can't punish you for it. It's not going to be a bad thing as of yet, right? If there is no law in on the books, which requires a person to recycle. So in this neighborhood, he doesn't recognize that person, right? He's not required to do so. Now,
what about Jewish laws that stuff in stuff? Laws in Torah that you weren't aware of, that you were breaking?
No, but they exist around the books.
What was if you had never come to them before? They had never come to you, you didn't know.
Isn't that like saying, like meeting a cop and saying, you know, I didn't know this was forbidden to be here. Right? You still broke the law. He's probably still going to give you the ticket. Unless you're persuasive enough.
Well, that's interesting, because they can only give you the ticket if it's clearly shown that this is an area where there's a speed limit. If there's no sign
that
there's a speed limit, they can't give you a ticket.
Of course.
Because you weren't to know.
Right. But let's say you got on the road between the signs.
There's ways around it to the traffic, the light, the distance of the light, so it's quite hard. You should know your code.
Whatever, you pick another thing. Obviously, there are issues which you can have, which are, you come from the, I don't know, I'm not sure offhand what I can come up with, but the point is that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. But if no law has been legislated, then you can't call a person a bad person for not, he's not, it's easy to use the Hebrew terms for that. There's a concept of a chassid, not a chassid in terms of the chassidic movement. The concept of a chassid means somebody who has this altruistic personality, who everything he does is geared towards doing good towards God, towards his fellow man, towards everything which exists. That's a very high level to reach. So therefore, I'd be loath to assume that that's demanded of every person. Because it's simply such a high level, there's some people then who focus, who think that they're being altruistic, but they're fooling themselves. In other words, the person is going to say, well, look, I'm very environmentally friendly. At the same time, in some other part of their lives, they're completely unethical. So therefore, it's dangerous to live in one area of your life above the level which you're achieving in other parts. It's supposed to advance, you know, in some sort of symmetrical way.
Aren't we talking about internal controls here?
Not necessarily. What do you mean internal controls?
In other words, you know, if you have no control, you can achieve, you know, but if you're trying to be altruistic, you have to modulate your behavior in a certain way. You know, to reach those goals.
Right.
Well, that's modulating behavior is part of being, part of controlling your impulses.
Right. You have to be very self-aware if you're going to try and do that. You want to say something about this, or should I go to the next question?
I will try. Well, in any of this, but to be a chassid is one thing. To do something with a hill of Hashem or a kiddush Hashem seems to be another. You don't think, well, it's nice if someone wants to do a kiddush Hashem. And it's not so bad if they do a hill of Hashem. I mean, we don't think
there's a level in the middle. Level in the middle, though. No, but you're not. It's not there. The level in the middle.
I haven't said anything yet.
You said kiddush Hashem, kol Hashem.
I know there is this and there is this, but I'm saying that's not to say that those categories are somehow beyond. That it's nice that someone does something that say the goyim look and see this and say it's nice that Jews do that, and it's nice that someone wants to do something that will make people think positively of Jews. I can't do it now. There's so many questions that have accumulated that went another direction. I can possibly formulate what I've been thinking.
But I just want to say that there's kiddush Hashem and there's chul Hashem and then there's neutral.
Or not caring what the
goyim
think.
No. You should care what the goyim think.
Why?
Because you don't want to make a chol Hashem. But there's certain things to try to... What?
Why do we in a post-Holocaust era, where in quote-unquote they, quote-unquote, did so much to us that why should we care what they do? We should be able to live our
because
lives.
Because that's our mission.
And live off of the...
Because that's our mission.
Government.
It doesn't matter. That's our mission. You can't shirk the mission. The mission is that you're supposed to be an example to everybody else.
Okay. And in doing that, when we make decisions based on a rubric that we feel transcends this world, wherein we feel that actions we do in this world have an effect not simply on this world in one dimension or in some next world, but in dimensions of this world, that it's simply right to do this, it's simply wrong to do these kinds of things. When we do things that we know lead to the impoverishment of other people's lives or the taking of other people's lives, we shouldn't necessarily go into these decisions in a carefree manner. Ultimately, I'm not really culpable for having purchased this product or engaged myself in this nefarious business like Enron or Shell Oil in Africa, whatever the given situation is. That goes with, trust me, I'm not saying that all these are perfect examples or anything of the sort. But when we engage in these things knowing full well that a business is not a person, a business is not a company is not a set of people who really make it. Everything comes down to the bottom line for them, and we know they're going to do it. We know for a fact that, say, these companies or this decision or not recycling accumulate to these things because everyone is shooting for the bottom dollar, which means not giving workers rights, not doing these things. And we know that they're going to, we know that our actions will have these consequences, and we know that the world sees us doing these things because we're Jews, and we have light bulbs on our heads,
okay,
no matter what we do.
Okay, so I want to get the other question before we finish. That's true. If somebody knows, anytime you buy a Nike sneaker, it's a Kol Hashem, because everybody knows, I don't know, just choosing Nike.
Yeah,
Nike sneakers are made by forced slave labor in China, then you're right. It would be a Kol Hashem to buy a Nike sneaker, even though it's not prohibited. You shouldn't own stock in the company because somebody might find out, and then they'll say, oh, the Jews are exploiting slave labor. That's true. So even though you don't commit any crime, according to strict American law, you should avoid the Kol Hashem. Absolutely. That's definitely true. But there's certain things that are baseline. In other words, things that are not considered to be either Kol Hashem or Kiddush Hashem.
Which is baseline. The law that establishes the baselines from which we view these things and see in this situation and say, doing this and doing this would be good and doing this would be bad. And if people read in newspapers that, oh, this rabbi came out and said that this was a good thing, even if all the Jews knew that doesn't mean they had to do it. If the Goyim saw that this was being said and being discussed in Jewish circles, people would be impressed by this. If they saw that a community, Omen Roe, has this policy, or whatever, has these thinkings on these issues, people think this way about Jews. But if the general policy that we even discuss among ourselves is one that's like, it doesn't matter, we shouldn't feel culpable for these things because ultimately it doesn't matter that we what decisions we make in choosing a product in investments in companies.
Okay. We agree on this. Kiddush Hashem means to sanctify God's name means to make a good impression. Primarily it's supposed to make a good impression on other Jews. Kiddush Hashem is to desecrate God's name. So Kiddush Hashem, one is put in this world to try and accomplish as much Kiddush Hashem, as much sanctification of God's name as you can by being an exemplary person, and to try and avoid making as much Kol Hashem, desecrating God's name by being a rotten person. So this is besides yourself, your internal divine service. There's this external thing also, which is you have to be concerned about how you portray what it means to be somebody who's Jewish. That's a very important thing. Okay.
What's the middle level? You mentioned a middle level.
Most people in this world, they don't necessarily have. You know, you think of the suburbia. I always think of Staten Island is a great example. There are lots of people who just live, right? They live and they live. They raise families. You know, they retire, they die. You know, they don't have impact on other people.
They don't see themselves having impact on other people.
No. Okay, you can argue that point, but I'm saying that would be neutral. Okay, if theoretically you have people who live to themselves, you know, your average American family, and they really don't have major interactions except with their close friends, so you could argue that those people are not on the front lines of what is Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem. But then there are other people who have major interactions or have major major visibility where it becomes much more sensitive.
Jews.
What? No. No, he wants to say every single Jew is highly visible.
No,
maybe? Okay, no.
Religious Jews. The ones with the Kiddush.
Okay, every religious Jew is highly visible. Okay, fine. Maybe. That might be true. Okay. They're identifiable. I understand. Okay. Now getting to your question before, the dress code issue.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting, there was a fellow who was one of my heroes, who failed in his mission. Many most heroes fail, but they were heroes for trying. His name was Dr. Nathan Birnbaum. I actually wrote an article about him. It's available on my website if you want to go read it. And he was about Shula. He started out being, he was one of the early Zionists. In fact, he made up the term Zionism. He then became a Yiddishist, which means he was into Yiddish culture, which, as you know, doesn't imply any connection to Judaism. And then eventually became Baal Tshuva. And when he became a Baal Tshuva, you know, he became gung-ho about Judaism. But then when he discovered about Judaism as a concept, when he discovered Orthodox Jews, he wasn't so happy anymore. So what happened was that he actually attempted to change the face of Orthodox society. One of the things he attempted, many things he tried to do, which in essence were bringing Musar which are personal ethical issues, and expanding them into the public arena of how a society should look. So one of the things he had in mind, in fact, in what it is in his Socialist Manifesto, when he spoke about what should be done, is he said Jews should have a specific architectural taste. They should be simple, you know, functional and simple. They shouldn't be lavish and outlandish. Jews should dress in a simple, respectable way. They shouldn't dress in a lavish and outlandish way, and so on and so forth. It didn't work, because it's so much at odds with the concept of what personal freedom in Western society and pursuit of material possession and material ostentation that he actually failed. I don't think he failed. He might not have failed had he not had the Second World War not happen, but anybody who was left, he died in 1936, but anybody who was left who was attempting to follow his path, they were all killed in the Second World War, so basically things ground to a halt in any event. So, yes, in theory, Judaism should have a lot to say about how large your house is, or how ostentatious it is, and how what kind of cars you drive, and what kind of clothes you wear, and how society should regulate itself, and the Hasidim do that. If you're part of a Hasidic sect, if you live in Monroe, then your society regulates to a large extent many aspects of your life. But for most of us, it doesn't work that way. Is that the way it should be? No, it shouldn't be that way. But the reality is that it's hard to impose these, so to speak, high standards on Western society-based Jews. So, yes, there should be a dress code, but there isn't. Okay, now, in terms of large families, This is actually, of course, a big issue in Judaism because there's not enough money in order to support everybody who needs to be supported. And the schools don't get enough money to pay their teachers and so on and so forth down the line. So what are you supposed to do about that? So there are many things one can do, but one of them is not to decide to limit the size of one's family for financial reasons. There are other reasons to limit the size of one's family, but not for financial reasons. Because we have a concept in Judaism, which is a very fundamental one, which we have not discussed recently, which is called bitachon. Bitachon means trust in God. And you have to trust God. This is a basic tenet of Judaism, that you must trust God that in terms of your situation, your monetary situation, things will somehow work out. I shouldn't say must. It's a strong term, but it's highly advisable. And it's something which we hold as a very important value, that a person should trust God that things will work out. And therefore, since one is supposed to trust God, doesn't mean one is supposed to trust God and not pay any attention to the bottom line. No, you should try and pay attention to that too. But after all is said and done, you have to trust that God will give you the resources to cope with the situation. And each person gets resources based on, we assume, the amount of people he has to feed or the amount of people he has to deal with. Now, he might not live in lavish luxury. This is an important point to note. Because the person who has, two kids, a husband and wife and two kids, he'll be able to perhaps to live on a much higher level of comfort than a person who has 12 kids. But, so what? In other words, who says you should seek to live at that level of comfort of the two-child family and not at the level of comfort of the 12-child family? If that's what you should be doing, then it doesn't matter whether you're going to have to live a more simplistic life. So that's the idea of bitachon, to trust God is going to give you what you need in order to survive at the level you are intended to survive, no matter how many kids you have, if that is the only reason why you don't want to have more children is a financial reason. That's called being tough. Trust. Yeah?
That whole even if you fulfilled the mitzvah of having children, even the Machaner approach of two boys and two, like one boy, one girl, I heard it's a lenient approach, and two boys, two girls,
One and one. Yeah.
So if you have one and one, and then after that, you don't want to have any more kids for financial reasons. You can't be self-our kids.
No rabbi will ever give you a rabbi. Right. That's happy. Yeah. So that's not a legitimate reason. They're emotional reasons, health reasons, but not financial reasons. But that, as far as that's concerned, is we do have to have trust. We talk in Hashem that Hashem will actually give you what you need in order to make ends meet.
And then another question: if you just have a bunch of girls, girl after girl after girl, like it's 7 girls in a row, and for emotional or health or whatever of those valid reasons there are not to have any kids, since you still haven't had a boy yet, should you keep having kids so you have a boy?
You're probably trying to wrap it up in the end with you. It's usually worse if you have more boys than if you have more girls.
Yeah. Or
boys are more trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that after this game, ties in so much to the environmental issue. Because from reading, being reading to the chef, it's kind of like you have to endeavour as much as you can to do everything you can, but you have to have the soccer. So with the environment, one of the most difficult things is we're totally limited by our intellectual capability as mankind. So we don't know if it's better to wear leather shoes as environmentally friendly or plastic as environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So you just strive as much as you can, and you have to have that faith that Hashem will do the rest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only answer, I think.
By the way, I am the author of one of the few articles written about recycling in Judaism.
Oh, really?
I
wrote
in Hebrew.
Oh.
So, getting someone's translation.